John.
Good morning, Barry.
We're here. We made it.
Yes, we are here. Yeah, the weather's pretty good here. It's 65, going to probably get up to 75, 85, maybe out in the suburbs. So looking to a nice, sunny, warm day.
Yeah, we're looking kind of the same. We're a little overcast now, but it's going to burn off. So we're going to be good.
Yep, all good. So we got some good stuff to talk about, too.
Oh, we got some great stuff.
No doubt. Why don't I start it off with giving a little follow-up on our last podcast, which we talked in sports section about the mascots of Major League Baseball, and one of them that we cited that's very popular is Mr. Met.
Yes.
Well, apparently during the week on Wednesday, Mr. Met got acted a little human and got very frustrated with the performance of his team, the New York Mets, and proceeded to flip off a fan during a ball game. The Mets right now are about 8 or 9 games out of first place, and they're expected to do a lot better. So, the fact is, I just want to point out that the Met was flipping off a fan is easy for the mascot. He's got 3 fingers, so
yeah. I didn't know they had 3 fingers like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, 3 fingers like the cartoon critters do, and so 3 fingers and a thumb. Some thumb. So if you take the more narrow definition of fingers and exclude the thumb, of course we then have 3 in the middle.
Okay.
Humans, we take a broader definition of fingers and include the thumb, and therefore we can also be anatomically correct too.
Oh.
So the Mets took care of this, violation or the inappropriate behavior of their mascot by internally, which means that they basically replaced the person inside the costume with another one. And they continue to probably employ the person who flipped the finger because they were envious he was able to do that and not get fired.
Oh, man.
So it's just a little follow-up because we talk so much about those mascots, and they're not always funny. Sometimes they get a little frustrated out there.
You're
wearing one
like
of those
clowns.
Suits, and it's 80 degrees.
Yeah.
You're a little hotter in the collar.
Yeah, they're like the professional clowns. They're a very frustrated, alcoholic group of people. And I imagine there's a little of that with the mascots.
Well, I'll tell you what, the minor league mascots have a convention once a year. And the fact is, I don't think you would want to be registered with a hotel over the weekend in which they have their little foray activity, whatever they need to do when they congregate.
Wow.
The other thing about these mascots that we didn't mention before is that the minor league ones in particular are very sensitive about finding out their identity. We did a stadium tour, and we get to a certain part of it, and all of a sudden the tour guide says, stop. Before we go into the next room, I have to make sure that the mascot is not in there putting his attire on.
Ooh.
So we're talking about a very sensitive group of humans here. And I think your parallel to the clowns is quite appropriate.
Oh,
so
man.
Just thought I'd point that out. Mascot behavior there.
Yeah, Bobby Goldthwait.
So,
huh?
I'd like to move on to the sports segment, and we've got 2 shorter segments within that we want to discuss based upon some current activity that's taken place in one in baseball and one in golf. And these stories are not what you call they're pretty well known, but I think that I was able to come up with, I think, to be a unique angle to each of them that
yes.
Then you maybe don't know. So let's start with the baseball one. And the baseball one occurs on Monday when a pitcher by the name of Hunter Strickland of the New York San Francisco Giants proceeds to hit Bryce Harper, star player of the Washington Nationals, in the hip. It was about midway into the game. And Harper, the fact is he gets hit in the hip. It isn't like he's getting a beanball, which typically would start a brawl, a baseball.
Right.
In this case, just getting in the hip. Now, Hunter is a pretty hard-throwing guy. So, I mean, getting hit, we can, speak lightly of getting hit in the hip. But the fact is that this guy's throwing probably mid-90s at the very least. So he's going to leave a nice little strawberry patch on his butt
yeah.
as a result of it. But what's interesting about this story to start out with is that Harper then, without any thought, immediately rushes to the mound and starts a brawl. And so the thing is that what makes this an interesting example of what happens in baseball, because you see baseball players feel that the game, the veterans feel that the game needs to be played in the right way. And when it comes to hitting home runs, and this is where we're going to follow this up, is when it comes to hitting a home run, what players should not do is they should not be flipping their bat very high. They right. should not be staring as the ball goes out as they're admiring their tremendous physical feat. And right. they shouldn't be right. showing any sort of emotion as they're circling the bases and as a result of hitting his home run.
Yes.
Any of these three things can cause the pitcher to get a little upset. So what we have, and of course, the exception of this rule is if it's a walk-off homer. The walk-off homer, the pitcher is typically leaving the mound. It actually gets its name walk-off, not because of the walking around of the batter, but it's the walk-off with the pitcher off the mound into the dugout. That is the exception where the players get to get a little bit more, show a little bit about more of their showmanship.
Because they're not, they wouldn't be offending the pitcher because he's not there.
He's not there. Yeah, the game's over with. It's fine.
Okay.
But what we find is that when it comes to retaliation in terms of this playing the game by the right way, the retaliation quite often can take a long period of time to take place. So what I did mention to you and give you the background on why this took place is because almost 3 years ago, during the 2014 playoffs in the very first series called the Divisional Series, the San Francisco Giants, which were a wild card team, means that they were in second place in they didn't win their division, played the Washington Nationals in a series that resulted in the Giants winning the series 3-1. In two of those games, Bryce Harper hit a home run against Hunter Strickland. The first one might be under a little bit of dispute as to whether Bryce, who is he's a young kid, came up at the age of 19. He has a tendency to kind of get a little excited out there and show a little bit more showmanship than the veterans really should. So Bryce, on the first home run he hits during the first game of this series, it ends up being very close to the foul pole. So he's watching the ball as much, not only admiring the prodigious shot he has just done, but wondering whether it's going to be fair or foul. But it turns out to be fair, and he very slowly makes his way around the bases and offends the pitcher. The pitcher then, gives him the old stare down. And so it was mild. It wasn't what you would call, could cause another problem. A couple of days later in another game, Bryce Harper notices the pitcher is a little bit upset and kind of giving that stare down look, the menacing look. And Harper hits another home run. And this time he goes a little bit further and he goes around very slowly. And not only does he start staring at the pitcher, but he starts what we call chipping or chirping at him, which means he's just kind of, making little, not noises necessarily, but, kind of talking some smack and all that stuff. So he rounds the bases. And that is the last time during that series that Bryce ends up, this confrontation occurs. So when's the next time he's a relief pitcher.
Okay.
This is a relief pitcher, so as a result, he's not necessarily going to be in the game.
Okay.
He finally has a confrontation with them Monday, and that's what basically started it. So this demonstrates the fact that you can't necessarily settle these things up. Now, the part of the story that isn't really been publicized, because these players, this story still has legs, because they then have to, Major League Baseball has to suspend them. And once they're suspended, then what has to happen is they then have to then appeal. So they're in the appeal process. Bryce Harper has done his appeal process, and he is going to be suspended for three games. Hunter Strickland is, I guess, considered the perpetrator, so he's being suspended 6 games. Now, that's not much. Well, for a relief pitcher, that is an amount. It wouldn't be that much for a starter, because a starter can only pitch every 5 days. So what we have here is that the story that's interesting is the catcher of the San Francisco Giants, because the brawl itself has a code. The code is that everybody has to get out and be involved in the brawl. Now, sometimes they just get out there and stand and stare at each other, but that's not what happened in this case. Bryce Harper rushed out there and threw his helmet to the side. I don't think he was throwing it at the pitcher, and they were duking it out. They were actually throwing punches.
Wow.
So what you're supposed to do is the opposing teams are supposed to do, they're supposed to get out there and be a part of it, and there was some additional activity in terms of fighting in this. The interesting part is Buster Posey, the star player on the Giants, was just standing there watching it, which is what is really a violation of the code.
Right.
So everybody's saying, well, does this mean that basically as captain of the team and just watching it, he is not approving or giving a sign of approval of what Hunter Strickland did?
Right.
Well, I found out through a follower of our podcast, the guy I talked to periodically in sports who lives out there, that Buster Posey is under instructions from management because he has concussion issues to not get involved in these altercations. So he has a good reason for not being there, and he probably supports his teammate Hunter Strickland in the fact that he threw at him. So that's the interesting part. Now here's where the story gets interesting, because you say, well, what's the chance of a ball player getting a concussion, getting involved in one of these? Well, there were two Giants. One of them, his name is Jeff Samardzija. He's a pitcher, but he's also was a football player at Notre Dame. Jeff thrives on these brawls. He lives for them. He is always going to be the first one running out there and finding an opponent and start wailing away. So he rushes into the middle of the scrum and accidentally collides with one of his teammates. Well,
oh my God.
They collide by hitting heads against each other, and Samardzija is going pretty fast. So guess who's on concussion DL? Not Jeff, because he's more of the attacker.
Right.
The big guy who's about 6'5", 250 pounds, ends up going down, and he's on the concussion DL for 7 days.
Wow.
So it's got a piece of irony to it, too. But I just thought it was, when we end up getting into the ball season, baseball season, we end up getting into the brawl season, too. And this is a good example of what's called baseball's unwritten code.
Yeah.
So thought that was an interesting story that has a little bit different spin on it that I was able to see that you probably aren't going to be reading about.
No, I would think not.
So the next one is one that's also been noteworthy. On the same day last Monday was Tiger Woods. Now, I'm sure unless you live in a cave, you know what's happened to Tiger. Tiger got stopped for a DUI driving under the influence on Monday. And actually, he didn't get stopped because, you see, he fell asleep at the wheel on the side.
Yeah.
So he was passed out. And so the thing is that there is a Chicago connection to all this. But I'll give you just a little background, because most of the stories give you the background. Because, you know, the fact is that Tiger's downfall in terms of his golfing has had a couple of incidents which have led to, you know, problems. I guess the first one back in 2009 was his marriage. And actually, it involved a car, too, because it probably wouldn't have been noted as early if Tiger wasn't skedaddling as fast as he did out of his driveway and ended up hitting a tree with his car.
That's right. I remember that.
Driving lessons. I don't know.
Yeah, he does have driving issues, doesn't he?
He does have driving issues. There's no doubt. I mean, in fact, when they stopped his car, for DUI, they found that both of his tires on the right side were flat. So he apparently, you know, was dozing off and ran into the curb and pretty hard, and that was the result.
Yeah, I think he must have knocked the tires off the rim or something pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, that can happen even when you're sober and you accidentally maybe take a turn too sharp or something.
Yeah.
So the second thing that kind of led to the crumbling of his golf was his back problems. And back about 2000, since 2014, Tiger has had a series of operations for him. He's tried to jumpstart his career back, and it hasn't worked out. He's either played and have to withdraw, or he just withdraws from the front end. So we've got the back problems, and of course the most recent one being the DUI. Now, to kind of put this in the perspective of what you read about, the Tiger's story, which was kind of like, first you think, well, you know, with the marriage and the serial adultery that took place that was just exposed as a result of it. You would figure, well, Tiger's a jerk. Well, the problem is now that Tiger is kind of looking like a pretty tragic guy, and people are kind of feeling sorry for him.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly when you find out that he, you think DUI, well, the guy, and it's at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we were talking to Jerry about the fact that nothing good happens after midnight.
Correct. We told our kids that.
Yeah. So this is, and so your inclination is to say, well, another silly, immature thing done by this 41-year-old has-been golfer.
Well, it is an immature thing, but it's not what people think. It's not what was reported,
it doesn't
really
appear. And this has been out. I mean, Tiger put out Tiger is very sensitive to his image, which is part of what we'll talk about in Chicago part of this.
Yeah.
But the fact is that Tiger puts a statement out saying that his drowsiness was the result of him taking his back up, his back medication as he, recuperates from his most recent operation. And basically a combination of medication or some reaction to it is what caused him to have this happen. Well, they went through the whole protocol with respect to Tiger. And I would also like to talk a little bit about that, because it first came out that he refused the breathalyzer. Well, Tiger went through the whole thing. And I mean, they've got film of it. And it's a very, very sad story. I mean, he was asked to do the test where you're supposed to do the alphabet. And
right.
Most people, that's a misconception, because most people think you're asked to do the alphabet backwards.
Yeah.
But in most cases, the police ask you to do it forward. And that's what they asked Tiger to do. And when Tiger, they said, do you understand the instructions? And Tiger says, you want me to do the national anthem backwards, right?
God.
Ooh, a little off, Tiger.
Whoa, now wait a minute. I would not want to do that. That sounds tough. I don't think I could do that.
Well, yeah. And I mean, he did the other stuff, the physical stuff where, you're supposed to do the heel to heel and all the rigmarole. And of course, he failed all that. But the one thing that the sports writers were putting in, that he refused to do the breathalyzer, that's not true. Basically, what he did is they put the mask on him and he couldn't breathe.
Oh, my God.
Jesus. He just was so screwed up he couldn't breathe heavy enough to do the breathalyzer test.
Boy, now that's,
so
that's
Tiger
a little
said that he cooperated completely. And I see no reason that this can't be true. So where does this story sort of get a Chicago spin?
Well, first of all, you did point out on the breathalyzer, he got 0.00. He had no alcohol.
Yeah, he got 0.00.
Yep.
So that's right. There's no air. You can't really, so it was kind of weird. I wanted to also point out that part of the tragedy with Tiger is you've got this person who starts his career out in a fashion which has never been done before, and he ends up being so close to some of the all-time records. He's 3 tournament wins from Sam Snead's 82. He's 4 wins from Jack Nicklaus's 14 grand, major championships, U.S. Open, PGA,
right.
British Open, all that good stuff. And so that's part of the tragedy. But where it gets a story in Chicago is the fact that our mayor Rahm Emanuel, is busy trying. Rahm, ooh yes, Rahm is has already secured a victory of getting the presidential museum and library into Chicago for President Obama.
Right.
This is going to be located, taking a small sliver out of Jackson Park down on the south side, about 6,000 south, occupied very near the University of Chicago, the Museum of Science Industry. It's got a lot of culture. It's got a good stuff. But it's also down there because it's very close to some areas which have had some challenges economically. There's some urban strife down there. And so they figured they could maybe, fuel that economy down there and do some good. The other piece of this is Jackson Park is also close to the lakefront, and it's got a golf course within it. It's got an 18-hole golf course, and adjacent to that course is an old country club, which has been taken over by the city of Chicago, is a 9-hole course called the South Shore.
Okay.
Well, Rahm's got this idea that first, Barack Obama loves to play golf. What
yes.
the hell? Why don't we put a championship course near the presidential museum? And he also says, we're right there near the lake. We could probably go full boat and make this a championship course.
Ooh.
And make it maybe where we could get some of the professionals to come and play a tournament here in Chicago.
Okay, that's good for the city.
Good for the city, you know, helps the economy. These golfers, you know, bring a lot of bucks in, of course, and there's the tourists that come in to watch the tournaments.
Sure.
They presently right now have every 3 out of 4 years they play the Western Open, but that is usually done in a suburb.
Right, right.
So what's happened here is this course is Tiger, as part of his foundation, kind of affiliated with it, has a design company that designs courses. Tiger design firm has been appointed to develop this course. The challenges lie in, there's a myriad of challenges in doing this course. One of them being that they're looking upon Tiger to be able to, with his fundraising capability, which is eroding, obviously, being able to pony up, or actually not pony up, but actually to secure some contributors that would pay the $30 million to renovate the two courses, bring them together.
Wow.
On the city side of it, there's a bigger challenge with the fact that since the course is located near the lake, it's not exactly there's a lakeshore drive in between, but still it's close enough where they feel a need to work on some of the erosion that takes place when you have the up on the shore. In addition to the fact that there's a road between the two courses, which is going to require them to build at least two underpasses to go underneath. And they're going to be challenged because obviously the water table level there is not going to be what you call real, real good because it's close to the water. So put all those pieces that are what we might refer to as infrastructure together. We're talking $60 million.
Wow.
So the problem we have here is that we're challenged both on the city side, in terms of the infrastructure that Rahm would have to put through. And I don't need to tell you, but in case you don't know, the state of Illinois right now is probably the worst physical shape of any state in the United States. They have not had a budget for 3 years. They're right now
that
over
is unbelievable.
700 days. And it's right now is when the budget should be done. Our fiscal year is June 30th. And sure enough, what's happened is that the Senate and the House and the governor have been unable to come together to grips. But that's a whole other story.
Wow.
But I'm just demonstrating the fact that the schools are suffering because they get a lot of their funding from the state and by way of it's a part of the funding mechanism that includes property taxes. So the perception is that if they're not able, if they're going to have to spend $60 million for a golf course, that's money that isn't going to go to the kids. So that's a problem in itself. And now we've got the problem with Tiger. So now this project, which had pretty good legs, you know, maybe a couple months ago, is looking a little shaky. So that's the part you probably don't know about. But take it even further. The Golf Channel is trying to spin a positive way that this can all come out so we can get the golf course. And that is the fact that we've got a potential help here by a man that has a net worth of over $740 million.
Yeah.
And that is Tiger Woods.
That is.
And Tiger Woods is always sensitive about his image. And the fact is that he could pony up a fair amount of this money and kind of maybe go to move this deal along. And the component that's critical in doing this whole thing with the championship course is to align it with a program that allows the kids that are on the south side of Chicago to get the opportunity to play golf. And so if they put that piece and they really prominently display that and get an active program to do that under Tiger's Foundation with Tiger's contributions, they might be able to resurrect the project. So I just thought it was kind of interesting to take a look at. When you take a look at Tiger Woods' downfall, there is some upside. And in addition to the fact, I'm not sure, most of the sponsors have left him. I feel the last one that's standing, I think it's Nike, that is still giving him $20 million a year, as far as I can tell. But that one's probably a little shaky after this most recent episode.
Yeah. So, I don't really get what the thing, maybe you can help me with this, John. I'm still stumbling over what's the terrible thing he did here. He didn't hurt anybody. He didn't drive while he was a wreck. He was taking medication. As far as I can tell, he didn't even have any alcohol in his system. So
right, and
what's the big scandal? And why is he so apologetic? He acts like you know, a little kid who got caught with his hand in a cookie jar. You know, he's gonna makes all these promises he'll never do this again, and so, and I'm just trying to figure out what's the big crime against humanity he committed.
I think there's two things here that are involved. Number one, you know, I don't think you might view it as a scandal, but I think most people view this as a tragedy.
Yeah, but he lost his sponsors. You're saying.
Well, the sponsors are looking at marketability, and I think that you're right. I think the sponsor thing is you know, kind of an overreaction. And like I said before, the sponsors were, most of them left him. But you have to understand that a golfer, an active golfer, is going to be much better received in terms of sponsorship.
Okay. So all right. I get
the sponsorship part of it plays into the fact he's not an active golfer to some extent. That's a big part of it. The incidents that took place, I would say the 2009 incident with the serial infidelity, along with the breakup of the marriage, it puts him into a more bad guy role than this whole thing with respect to the driving. The driving, I think, the DUI is more a case of an individual who is just a severely tragic figure. And I'll tell you, when it comes to being a bad guy versus a good guy, I thought, well, let's look back and see Tiger's life and what in it would create this. Did he have a split home? Was there something in terms of his family not basically raising him properly? But we're looking at a person who probably there might be a piece of his, maybe his life was overcome with golf too early. And as a result, he didn't live a full life.
No, he didn't. He's like Michael Jackson, didn't get to become a child, really.
Child, right. Now, you have to understand that Tiger's, he became prominent in golf at the age of 3.
Yeah, he did.
I don't know if you know what happened at the age of 3, but at the age of 3, he's on the Mike Douglas show. And he's on there, and he's, you know, demonstrating his golf ability at the age of 3, in addition to the fact that he's doing Bob Hope's on the same show, and they're having a putting contest, and Tiger wins.
Wow. Okay.
At the age of 3.
That explains it all, I think, doesn't it?
So, the fact is that he then, by the age of 5, his father was purportedly a scratch golfer. He played a lot. He was in the service. He retired a lieutenant. He retired a lieutenant colonel. His mother is primarily Thai. He met her while he was in the service. It was his second marriage, but she has always been a really, she's been the backbone in terms of, you know, discipline and keeping him going. His father has been more into the physical golf aspect of it. But by the age of 5, Tiger has to get a pro to help him because his father's run out of tricks. He can't help him anymore, instruction wise. So you can see that on an early life, it basically smothered him in terms of his life. But he did go to a regular high school, located in California. He then got a golf scholarship and went 2 years to Stanford. And when you hear about his experience in Stanford, this isn't a guy who basically stands out there as the greatest golfer, amateur golfer ever. They put him through. The golf team has actually got some pretty good golfers. Two of them have been on the pro tour. So they're not exactly what you call slouches. They were considered the best golf team, college team in the country at the time.
Right.
But they put him through the freshman stuff, you know, the making him carry bags and do various stuff that you know, sort of, what do they call that? In
hazing?
In fraternity hazing. They did a mild kind of hazing to him. And Tiger was very receptive. He didn't balk. He did everything they asked him to do.
Jeez.
So you see a guy who's probably been overwhelmed and not being able to do some things. But you just can't put your finger on saying, well, here's a guy who's basically been fractured from day one. I don't see that. So that just adds to the tragedy of the whole thing. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And if maybe the golf course can take, I'd sure like to see I have no problem with them having a nice golf tournament here and also giving the kids in the South Side a chance to experience some golf. And that would all be good. But like I said, we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Wow. What a deal. Bottom line, don't get any back surgery. Find another way. You know, go to an acupuncturist, anything.
The fact is that golf is back problems is a occupational hazard of golf, and usually you don't hear a lot about it, but there are some other golfers who've had it.
Sure.
And it can lead to a shortening of the career, or at least it can inhibit your career and may not make you as effective.
Sure. Sure.
So those are my two sports scoops of the week.
And, okay.
Moving onward to film.
Oh, well, you know, we're doing something probably every podcast that ever talks about anything does, but I think we're justified in doing so. We're going to talk about the film The Godfather. Now,
it is appropriate to talk about this movie because we're in the 45th anniversary, and I'll tell you, TCM is doing a big deal on it. And there's also five DVDs that are going to come out
with all the background
with a
stuff.
New one.
Yeah.
With, you know, five DVDs of the whole series of three pictures plus a bunch of new commentary, like you've said.
Yeah.
So, the fact is that the timing is right in terms of discussing this because it is being celebrated again on its 45th anniversary.
Yeah, now when you talk about those compilations, those multi DVD, multi disc, whatever you want to call them, deals. The thing about those is there is a version of The Godfather that is completely chronological. That it goes from what's his name? Vito's father's
early life
death.
Don Corleone, played by Marlon Brando, obviously played in the earlier part by another actor.
It follows. It starts with Vito Corleone's father's funeral.
Oh yeah, Vito.
Yeah, and then goes all the way to the end, which is Godfather 3. There is a version of that, so that's something people sometimes like. But you know what? I'm just gonna say it.
Yeah.
The only Godfather movie that really, really got me was Godfather. Period. The first one, and here are my reasons. There's Coppola had to fight to get some of his decisions into this movie because he had a lot of pressure from executives. By the time he did the second and third, he had the clout that he could do more of what he wanted. And my contention is that his impulses are not always the best ones to follow when it comes to things like casting, because he always has a tragic flaw in his movies where he casts somebody who's really not quite ready for the part. And that gets worse in 2 and 3, in my opinion. Plus, the other thing is, because of the contention he had with the studio and the fact that he had to fight for what he got, I think he did a better picture. I think that what he got with his collaboration with Puzo, what he got with his casting, what he got, everything he got was better in the first one. And of course, it has to be said, Marlon Brando brings something to a movie that is impossible to measure, except you know it when you see the movie. When Brando works in a movie, I mean really works, not just walks through it, but works in a movie, it changes everybody in the cast, it changes everybody on the crew. It changes a lot of things because he's a real force. And so that's what happened with Godfather 1. You know, if you read any of this stuff or watch any of the DVDs about the background stuff, if Brando's happy in a movie and he's being Brando, then he's a great prankster. He does stuff that really cracks people up. He keeps them on their feet. He keeps a kind of electricity going through the movie that otherwise would not be there. And that's what I like about The Godfather. Plus, there's sentimental reasons. 72, this movie comes out, and I had just married my wife of 43 years, Mary Jane Mara. And
good mathematics.
Thank you. She comes from a family. She comes from a family that really loves movies and plays and such. They're from D.C., and that kind of... very different kind of people than our family, John. They're a little different. They just have that DC culture thing going on. And you and I had always watched movies, but for me, it was just a great way to get out of the house, and I was stunned by the colors on the screen. But other than that, I never really got into movies. You probably got into them more than I did. But
yes.
In 1972, Mary Jane talked me into going to this movie. And I said, well, okay, is it really that good? And she is a kind of understated person, and just something about the way she said, yeah, I realized that this must be a really good movie. So I went, and it was a long movie, so I was a little reluctant. Well, what I noticed first when I saw this movie, at the end of it, I had not moved my head. In fact, my neck was extremely cramped up from not moving. I was struck. I was unable to take my eyes off of the screen, and I couldn't believe what I'd seen. This was the first time in my life I'd seen a movie that was a real movie, and it was, I really saw it too. It wasn't like, you know, I sat through it or was trying to make out with my girlfriend or anything like that. This was a real movie. So, and a real movie experience. So it changed my life. I started to think about movies differently because of The Godfather. So it's a favorite of mine. And
right.
I watch
I would
it frequently.
Say that if I, yeah, I, when I take a look at this movie, I'm, you know, it's the kind of movie that if it comes on again, I'm gonna be watching at least a part of it.
Sure.
But I think going back to the background in terms of why this movie stands out, because this movie is not one, we're not in a minority here. This is considered by most people to be in the top five, if not maybe the best movie ever made. It kind of rivals with Citizen Kane if you take a look at it. But it's a one or two all-time movie.
Yes, it is.
It also, at the point of its peak in terms of its financial success, it was the highest grossing movie at the time that it came out and with a success. But I think what really, and you've alluded to this, I'll just give a little bit more information, is that the build-up, primarily the Brando part, but the fact is Francis Ford Coppola and the author of the book, Mario Puzo,
yeah,
also plays a role into the anticipation we have with this whole thing. I mean, the marketing of it was fueled by real-life things happening. And it starts with the fact that we've got a bestseller on the New York Times list for 67 weeks, published in 1969.
Right.
That fuels, you know, the story. So it's got a lot of legs in terms of that. But the whole way in which Paramount Studios gets involved in this is kind of interesting, too, because, you see, they were proactive in actually getting the movie rights to this. They got the movie rights way before the book even came out. In fact, they signed the contract with Puzo for the movie rights before the book was even finished.
Wow, I didn't know
they
that.
They did it based upon a 67-page manuscript, of which Puzo was in a position where he desperately needed money because he was he's a gambler.
Yeah, that's right.
So he had these gambling debts that he had. So against the advice of his agent, he signs a deal where basically he sells the rights to the option for the thing for $12,500 if they don't make the movie, and an option for $80,000 if they do make the movie.
Chump change.
So he's basically, for less than $100,000, he sold the rights to this movie.
Oh, my God.
Now, of course, he urgently paid off his $10,000 bank debt as a result of signing. And I guess he does get a little bit, not a little, but he does get $100,000 because they go to him to assist in the writing of the screenplay.
Right.
So that's an interesting piece of it. I think the other one, which is one you talk more about, is the Marlon Brando piece.
Yeah.
And his ability to get Brando, because first thing is Paramount was very skittish and had and was closely looking through this. Their management style was to be hands-on completely, because they had gone a bunch of dud movies, including a movie about the mafia called The Brotherhood starring Kirk Douglas, just didn't make it. What Francis Ford Coppola is able to do is he realizes he needs to have characters that,
yeah, believable.
Live the life of the Italians, the believable Italian.
Yep.
And he was always set on Marlon Brando playing the main role of Don Vito Corleone.
Yep.
And but he ran against tremendous resistance.
Yes, he did.
And the fact is that Paramount knew that Brando's most recent experiences with filmmaking led to usually tremendous delays in production, this and that. In other words, running up the budget or going way over budget. So the other thing was that I thought was kind of interesting is that the way that Francis Ford Coppola was able to get Brando to do a screen test. And the fact is, Brando, you know, it would be beneath him to do a screen test. So what he did is he said, basically, you've got the role, but we have to do some, we have to basically test you out for makeup.
Yep.
So what they do is, and that's where you get this whole thing about the fact that that Brando, in order to play the role, puts the tissue paper into his mouth to get a certain configuration. And also, I think it helps him in terms of his speech delivery.
Yep.
You know, and all of this.
Yeah, he dyed his hair and put shoe polish on his eyebrows.
All these different things, but it's all makeup driven.
Yep.
That he thought he was doing a makeup test when basically he was doing a screen test, which he felt that Francis Ford felt would get him a better chance of getting the person he wants in the role. So it was a it was basically came down between Ernest Borgnine and Brando, and fortunately Francis Ford won out, was able to convince Paramount to do the role. And what's the other thing that's kind of interesting, Brando is like 47 or 48 years old, so he's actually a little too young for the role. So
yeah, they had to put 20 years on him. Yeah.
Yeah, they had to put the age on him. So that, to me, are the things that on the front of the movie kind of whet your appetite for this. And so you have a bunch of eagerly anticipated painting fans, movie fans out there just chopping at the bit to watch this flick. So the other thing that I find, which is more, which I think your second thing about our families, is the fact that when Francis Ford Coppola saw this, read what he did to the manuscript, his reaction to start out with was, I don't think I want to do this movie.
Mm.
I don't really want to do it.
Because it glamorizes the life.
It basically, he said, this is just another mafia movie. But then after reading it and thinking about it, this isn't a mafia movie. This is a family movie.
Yes.
This is a movie about a family.
Yes, it is.
And the platform is basically, the setting for it is the mafia, the gangsters.
Correct.
So they're running into problems that basically, you know, I know they're a little bit over the edge in terms of the violence. But the fact is that they're dysfunctional. There's external forces creating problems in their family. There are internal forces creating problems with the family. And I think that, you know, the development of the family that is mostly emphasized by the development of Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, where he goes from it appears at the beginning of the movie, kind of a starstruck kid who the Don figures, let's not get him involved in the business. We'll stick him with a political career, and he'll help us from that end when we need it.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he's thrust into the role of becoming the Don because of the death of Sonny, and also because of the older Corleone is doesn't have the
Fredo's
mental
diminished
capacity.
Yeah, he's diminished in some way. We don't know exactly how.
In many ways. He can do some things, but he's clearly not a leader.
Right.
So all of a sudden, Michael gets thrust in the role, and he goes from this, what appears to be a relatively sweet kid that's going to have nothing to do with the biz, to becoming ruthless.
Oh, yeah.
Way beyond whatever Don Vito Corleone's father would ever do.
Well, I'm gonna take exception to that a little bit, because I think the way I thought about this a lot, and I watched the movie again last night, was what you see is you see that Michael had the brains, had the cunning, had the strategic thinking of his father. He was just like his dad in that regard. And his father was every bit as ruthless. However, his father had the heart side of it covered. He was really good at reaching out and in extending his friendship to people. He said, I believe in friendship, and I believe in showing it first. So that was always the way he rolled. And so, but Michael didn't have that. Michael was much colder. And I think in terms of ruthlessness, in terms of intelligence, they were a match set. But definitely Don Vito, maybe as a, you know, look at his life and what he went through. I think that fueled a part of it. He had a side of him that was compassionate and was warm, as well as being a cold-blooded killer. And he somehow reconciled these things. There's not many humans who can do that. So no doubt Michael would not turn out exactly like Vito, would not be able to create an empire exactly like his father, Vito. But man, here's my basic take on it. It's not too long. First time I watched this movie, it was 2 years after Pop died after our father died. So my first go through with this thing, the scenes that hit me the hardest were, you know, Vito has been shot 5 times and he's in a hospital and he's on death's door. And now his guards have been taken away by the police. And now Sollozzo and his goons are going to come in and finish the job. Michael ends up there by happenstance, and it goes pretty well, and he manages to get the nurse to take his father out of there, and he's in a room alone with his father, and he says, "I'm with you, Pop," you know. And so this brought me to tears the first time I saw it, because I never got to see my father when he died, or as he was dying even. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years when he died, and I was on the outs with him. So, you know, this was a heavy moment for me. The movie at that time in my life, in 1972, was the apex of the movie was that scene. It led up to that, and then it evolved from that. So, here it is, 45 years later, as you pointed out, John. And now I watched the movie again last night. Well, my life is different now. I've really come to terms with the death of my father and the terms upon which we were at that time. But now, you know, November 5th, my son died. And so now the movie leads up to Sonny getting assassinated and, you know, everything after that. So now the whole apex of the movie for me has shifted. And it was a beautiful thing to watch again. So now I notice all the details and all the nuances completely differently this year when I watched it, as opposed to all the other years I watched it, because now there's a new center of gravity for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it is beautiful. And I really did enjoy watching it. And I got a lot out of it. It was, you know, there's details that you don't notice if you're watching the movie from a certain angle that you will suddenly notice. It an amazing movie. My gut at the time I saw the movie was I thought Michael Corleone was what's his name? The guy who played
Al Pacino.
Al Pacino. I thought Al Pacino was a little light for the part. You know, I wouldn't feel like that today, of course. And I thought his role in Godfather 3 was magnificent. I thought he did a great job. But Godfather 2 and Godfather 1, I did not think so. I thought he was not quite ready for prime time. And there have been a lot of actors like this. Paul Newman, when he started out, was just a pretty boy. And he became a great actor. And, you know, there's lots of others like that. And I'm going to have to say, same is true for Al Pacino. And he had certain visual and acting things he would fall back on that seemed a little repetitive to me and not spontaneous. You know, little things like that. I thought his transition from, like John, like you said, kind of a doe-eyed kid to the Don. He had this stare, this thing he would do with his eyes when he transformed into the Don of the family. It was very good. That's the one thing I'm going to give full credit for. That was magnificent. He really did an incredible job on that. But, you know, everything leading up to it, it was so fast to me, anyway, in the story. I didn't quite have the effect it could have had if he was a more nuanced actor, but he was young. What are you going to do? A little flawed, but the other people that they wanted to play his part would not have worked either. So I'm good with the final outcome. It's a masterpiece. It's one or two, like you say, John. It's the best. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I would say that I take more objective. I don't relate it as I rate a little bit the family, not quite as much as you do, Jerry. I'm more into the visual, the what you see out there on the screen in terms of the. Not only the acting, but the setting and the way they were able to do the period piece. One of the things, there's a couple things here that Francis Ford, he won all the way with Paramount. I mean, this guy was behind the scenes, must have been an incredible person and able to get everything he wanted. Two things Paramount was really pushing hard for to cut down the cost was number one was to keep the setting the same, but not film it in New York. And they were thinking of filming it in Kansas City.
Yes.
Oh, that's scary just thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. How could they do that?
The other thing is that they wanted to make it contemporary and take it out of the 40s and 50s.
Oh, That would have been a nightmare.
Ford, Francis Ford won in both cases. Thank God.
Yeah, and look at what it did for the movie. I was watching it last night. I was just marveling at how they, you know, when he's driving the Jack Dempsey's, the use of light, or should I say the use of no light, or almost no light, I'd never seen in a movie like that. You know, we talked about film noir a few weeks back.
Yeah.
And this is not film noir. It's a gangster movie. But the use of darkness in this movie was so effective. And then also things like streetlights. You look at those streetlights that they had in Brooklyn when he was driving out the Dempsey's.
Yeah.
Completely authentic. I know, because I saw lights like that. The toilet in the restaurant where he hid the gun. Completely authentic, including the wood frame that they had the tank in. You know, it's just every little detail they had perfect. The plane landing in Los Angeles with Robert Duvall to talk to Waltz about getting Johnny Fontaine, that picture, you know. All that stuff, just perfect, perfect, perfect. And let's not forget the use of Italians. And that starts with Francis Ford Coppola. Because.
Yes, it does.
That's why. I mean, they learned their lesson with gangster movies. You got to have real Italians, believable Italian Americans at least, in this movie. And so they chose him, and he did a great job of getting the right people in there. Jimmy Caan is one of the, you know, exceptions to that. He was able to pull off Sonny somehow. Don't ask me how, but he did. And but you look at the rest of the cast, Lamenza, Abe Vigoda is not Italian, but you know, hey, he's Mediterranean, that'll do. And you know, they had it.
They really there are two Jewish people in the movie that basically are kind of considered miscast. I know that Abe, I think, was one of them. But I want to point out that again with you know, we've sung the praises of Francis Ford Coppola, but I think we need to realize the challenges lie in the fact that this man, and what I've read through Wiki and this other, so subject to some debate as to the exact number, but they quote the fact that he was their 12th choice.
Yes, correct.
So as a result, he's not exactly what you call on the front end a lock. And if you're 12, you're basically, in addition to being micromanaged, and a man who basically his best movies are still in front of him,
yes,
including Godfather, obviously, he is going to be watched very carefully. And part of the problem, which we admire, is the shadow darkness in the movie. Paramount was scared about it really bad, to the extent that during the movie they even wanted to replace Francis Ford with Elia Kazan.
Correct. Correct.
So,
they thought he was making bad choices.
Bad choices. They thought the shadows, all kinds of things. They also, hey, here's another thing. You know, a lot of times you figure that the problem here is that he goes over time budget, he goes over a dollar budget. But the bottom line is he brought this movie in under budget in both cases.
Yeah, that's funny. He got a bad rap. And of course, in the future, he did that.
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now was a nightmare.
Other movies.
Apocalypse Now was a nightmare.
Yes. That's the one that basically you hang your head on and say, this guy is you know, stumbling, bumbling, whatever, and taking too time making a movie.
Yeah.
But the fact is that go ahead.
I forgot, you know, this is off the subject. So one of the things is he's fond of putting family members in these movies and using his father for some of the music in 2 and 3. And, you know, I'd forgotten that it was Sophia Coppola who was the baby, Michael.
Yes,
Michael Rizzi.
The baby. His sister, Talia Shire, plays the wife,
Connie.
Plays Connie.
He loves to do that. And I believe, it's not him. I think it's the other great Italian director, his peer, who has his mother come on the set and cook food. Who's the guy? You know.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Probably.
Yeah, anyways. Well, we'll get into that. But, I mean, I think Coppola does something similar to that. They ate together and all of a sudden. It got down to the point where, you know, there were a fair number of eating scenes in the movie. And so, as I understand it, Coppola gave a lot of the guys who weren't Italian and some of the Italian Americans who were, you know, kind of acculturated to America, taught them how to eat like Italians. You know, there's a way Italians handle bread that no other group of people on earth do. And I've seen it myself in person. It was funny. We were at out in Philadelphia, and I worked with a guy, Greg Perugini. And so we were going to go into this event, and the caterer was there, and they're bringing out food, and Greg was hungry. So, you know, he got him some food. And as soon as Greg grabbed the bread and took a piece off of it, the caterer said, "Another Italian." And I was kind of stunned. And then Greg turns to me, "Only Italians handle bread like this." And he's right. And they did it. I watched the movie this time, and they did it. You know, they do that. You saw Sonny doing it, who's not Italian.
Well, the family dinner thing was not only to bring the cast together and, you know, get them feeling comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
But part of it was that one person at each dinner had to basically, throughout the whole dinner, play the role, do their thing as if they
right.
were the person rather the person in the movie versus being
character.
Stay in character for and they didn't make everybody do it at once, but they made one person do it per dinner.
That's
nice. Thought that was kind of interesting.
That's very interesting
approach to it.
Yeah. Great movie.
But I also say there's one actor that we've talked about a lot of people in this movie, but one we haven't. That's Robert Duvall.
That is correct. Robert Duvall, and this is one of my favorite actors. You know, he has some mannerisms, some things that kind of go from character to character, but he's a pretty good character actor, all things considered.
Yeah.
And of course, the first time I ever saw him was when he played Boo Radley in Kill a Mockingbird,
I'd
have
a long
to say,
time. That's a 63 movie.
Well, you know, if it came down to me, if I had to choose between The Godfather and Kill a Mockingbird, I'd have a tough time. I love them both for different reasons and consider them in the very top tier of movies. And his part in that was pretty magnificent. That was a beautiful thing. And that's the first time I saw him. I don't know about you.
Yeah, well, I the thing is, Tom Hagen, we have to remember, he's the one against he's not the Italian. He's the
correct.
The lawyer. What do you call that, Jerry? A
consigliere. Yeah, it's the counselor.
That's
for the family. Yeah.
And so he's Irish. But
German
he's
Irish, by the way.
German
Irish.
Ah.
German Irish, remember? I'm German Irish. Well, let me tell you, my crap McFriend. Remember that? Wolf is talking to him, right?
He's an important part of the movie.
Yes, he is.
And so, hey, one other little tidbit on a little trivia, and then we can move on,
sure.
is the fact that a lot of the animal activists are very concerned. We're very concerned about the horse head that was used to scare the director of the movie.
Scare Walt into giving Johnny the part.
Yeah, and to get the Johnny Fontaine, the singer, to get his comeback into a movie. Which it kind of is supposed to be comparable to Frank Sinatra's getting the role in From Here to Eternity.
Yes.
Fact is that all they did was go to a dog food place and pick up a head. I mean, it wasn't like the horse would be killed anyway. So they just, you know, that's the way they did it. So I thought that was something that needs to be emphasized.
Yeah.
So,
I
think
we weren't quite
I'm
as so sensitive back then
again.
As we are today.
Yeah.
Maybe right. it could have, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been as good a scene today.
I don't know. It was a very shocking scene.
That was so effective.
The things,
if you read the book, okay, if you're a fan of this movie, first of all, read the wiki and you get all the background on the movie that you need. And then if you're really diehard, you have to buy the book and read the book because now the movie is very true to the book. What isn't in the movie is all the background stuff. The fact that Tom Hagen was, how he got brought into the Corleone family, how he ended up being more Sicilian than many of the other sons, because he just admired so much that way of life. He was the one who said, it means that Luca Brasi is sleeping with the fishes. He's the one who interpreted that for Sonny, not someone else. He knew the culture, he knew the language, he knew everything. When they brought him in, he was blind. That was another thing. He had lost his eyesight temporarily, but, you know, they got him the doctors he needed. They got him the education he needed. He was forever grateful to Vito Corleone for saving his life and bringing him in when he had no parents. He had nothing. And so that's remarkable. You know, that's a big thing that you won't know unless you read the book. There's all kinds of other background stuff, too, that is just Puzo really did a good job. Really did a good job telling the story. He's not a great writer. He's not somebody who will have the literary flourishes of Tom Wolfe or somebody else. But let me tell you, I don't think anyone told a story better than Mario Puzo, so I'm going to give him full marks for that. And I don't think anyone but Francis Ford Coppola could have brought it to the screen in the same way that he did. It could have been a real disaster of a movie, frankly. It could have been the usual casting a lot of white guys in Italian parts, then they can't do it, a lot of doing it on the cheap, all kinds of other crap. But man, the combination of events, Marlon Brando, Puzo, Coppola, made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
See it, watch it, read it.
Well, just to see it, if you want an immediate fix as we close up this segment, AMC is showing this movie Saturday. Now, I don't know what form it's going to be in. You know, if it's going to be sliced and diced and whatever to get it onto TV. And obviously, small screen, and we know the challenges of putting a movie that should be, you know, like a letterbox or whatever, you know.
You want it as immersive as possible. You want to forget you're in a theater, forget you're watching it on something. You want to feel like you're there.
And you will. But the bottom line is, if you need a quicker fix and you can't go out and get the DVD or do this or do that and stream it, it is going to be on regular TV too, our AMC cable TV. Okay.
Yeah, I watched it last night in the evening on my Chromebook, and it was very effective. You know, I would say, you know, it's the darkness of the movie is really fantastic, and if you can do something to allow yourself to just get sucked into it, then you have that immersion you're talking about, John. Okay, enough. Yes. Enough Godfather already. Let's go on and let's talk a little bit about the fake news. And so today we thought we'd talk some about the reemergence of our sister Hillary Clinton. And this is interesting. It comes at a real junction point of American politics where, you know, she had 3 million more votes, popular votes, than the guy who's president now. There was huge amount of controversy surrounding her, which ensnared so many different actors. It's kind of difficult to comprehend sometimes, but it did include Vladimir Putin. It did include Comey, the head of the FBI. It included the DOJ, the head of the DOJ. Everyone got ensnared in her campaign and got some of it on them. She feels she's the wrong person. And I understand that. I think she is to an extent. But she's been making her case. They did a huge article on her. And where was that article, John? Was that in The New Yorker? Or
New York Magazine.
New York Magazine.
And it was a woman author by the name of Rebecca Traser, put an extensive article in based upon an interview, probably the most comprehensive long interview that she's had since the defeat. And Hillary does open up. To some extent. And you see a little different perspective. You see the more private Hillary versus the politician Hillary, which we've been, you know, so used to for so many years, you know, with her career as a senator, secretary of state, you name it. We've seen a lot of that. And actually, it probably goes back to even her husband's presidency when she was given some rather ambitious tasks, such as trying to solve the health problem on the front end of bills. And they gave her a piece of that nobody was able to chew through. And if there's one thing about this lady is she is a hard worker.
She will work.
I mean, it's like she says in the article, she's not a show horse. She's a workhorse.
No, I agree. I totally agree. Now, the interesting thing about this article is you do get a look at her that you don't otherwise get. She's mischievous. She's even a little impish. She feels a freedom you can sense between the words. And it's nice. I wanted her to have that myself personally. I thought she really went through the ringer. And, you know, I was a Bernie supporter, so I'm not a big Hillary fan. But, you know, I probably agree with some of Trump's things, too. You know, so she's like a mainstream Democrat, big money, big solutions, et cetera. And I don't quite see the world that way. I'm a little more conservative and a little more progressive than she is. But personally, on a person basis, yeah, I felt like, holy cow. But in this interview, I felt like she had a little room to breathe. But the problem with the article, in my opinion, and John, I'd like you to weigh in this too, it was a sprawling article. It was like it went all over the place. If you're looking for any kind of closure or any crispness or anything at all, you're not going to get it. It's a day in the life or several days in the life of Hillary Clinton.
I think, yeah.
And that's
I totally
a slice.
Agree that.
It was a slice.
It is, but the problem with the article is that I'm a very structured writer. I think in terms of clarity rather than content,
right?
Or as much as about them,
right?
And this article has a way of interspersing another article. It doesn't have any time continuity to it,
right?
But what they've done is that the good piece of the article is that this woman was able to get to portray or to write down a piece of Hillary that we haven't seen before, or not as much of it. And I think that that's the strong feature of this. But, man, I'm reading through it, and I'm saying, are they talking about the other article, or is this the interview?
I read every word of the thing. I didn't scan it or anything, and I really took it seriously.
The problem is you read it, and then you have to read parts of it over again.
Correct.
Because you can't quite figure out. I couldn't get a time sequence on it. Figuring out which of this other article she was referring to. I'm going to give you kind of my perspective on Hillary, and it's based upon one incident which I have repeated endlessly to so many people.
That's true.
And it
you
involves,
have.
And as Jerry, you're well aware of, I can bring baseball into anything.
Well, you did
and
it
Hillary
with this.
And baseball, I can make it happen.
Yes.
Hillary is a senator from New York. Hillary is her whole childhood and her adolescence was in Chicago, and she was lived in Park Ridge, not far from O'Hare Airport. She was an ardent Cub fan.
Right.
So she goes on David Letterman, and here she is. I think she's running for the secretary, the New York Senate position.
Yep.
She's established residency, did all she has to do. And David Letterman poses this question to her and says, Hillary, if it's the World Series and it's the seventh game and the Cubs are playing the New York Yankees, who are you rooting for? And guess what? Hillary was not able to give a definitive answer to that. She tap danced around it. That, to me, was an indication we have a situation where a person cannot make a decision in terms of what I would consider to not be a critical decision. It's not what you call earth-shattering. It's not going to, you know, make a difference in the world. She can't come up with one answer.
Well,
I thought,
you raise an excellent point.
What you got to do when she's in the trenches?
You raise an excellent point. And that is what it's like reading that article, is that you get almost closure on a number of issues around her life, but you don't get closure. There's no snap. There's no punch. It's like her. That's what that article is. So
My favorite in the article is the fact when she starts this article and somebody says, "Well, what's your feeling about what happened to you in the election?" And she says, "I have to take total responsibility for my losing the election." And then she proceeds to give 7 or 8 points of why she feels she lost it that have nothing to do with responsibility.
Correct. Correct.
That's a good example of what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
We think we got closure, and all of a sudden we realize we don't.
No, there's no punch. There's no finality. There's no, you know, and that doesn't work. I mean, Trump era aside and all that other stuff. It's just, and that has been her Achilles heel throughout her career. She polls high when she starts, and then she barely wins when she does win.
I think the pieces of this article that I found interesting that are not necessarily relating to specifically Hillary is the fact that number one is that the challenges that a woman has in terms of doing this, they basically are up against the wall, and they're fighting a near impossible battle just based upon her gender.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she did a good job of covering the misogyny aspects of that, I thought.
Yes. Thought that was one. And sometimes the insight that the author of the article was able to give to specific moments during this whole exercise, like, everybody's kind of punched up in terms of Hillary's, supposed to win this and that. And they don't realize until very late in the game, practically just maybe 2 or 3 days ahead of time, that there's a problem here. And then they realize that the problem comes to fruition in terms of loss. Then the nice piece to me is, like, well, how's Hillary going to react to the loss, and how's she going to handle the losing. And I thought that
like
was
a
good
pro.
Piece for, yeah,
like
a
pro president.
She did, like a politician.
Like a president. He actually handled it like a president. That was the coolest thing I read in that article, and you probably saw the same thing.
Yeah. I thought that to me was the side of Hillary that was good. And
yes,
you would like to think that if she became president, she would, you know, remove that layer of politician and act that way.
Yep.
In terms of being a president. So
she would have.
I
been,
also thought
she would have been magnificent. I mean, I'm just going to say it. I think she would have been a great president, not just a good one. Sure, she would have had challenges. And yeah, she's got her limitations. Everybody does. But wow. I mean, yeah, I saw stuff in that article I was really happy about. There's another thing I watched last night after The Godfather. I watched her appearance at the Recode conference. It's a technical conference hosted by Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg. And they get some really outstanding speakers at this get-together. They had Steve Jobs and Bill Gates appear on the same stage, which is quite a miracle. So these are two tech heavyweights, great journalists, working for great publications. And they got Hillary Clinton. And I didn't listen to the entire interview, but the entire interview is on the Recode site. If you want to listen to it, you may like it. You know, I could only listen to about 32 minutes of it because I had a time limitation. But the one thing that came out during the interview, John, that was not in the article that I thought was really well done, she took the time, at the peril of boring the crap out of her audience, she took the time to explain how data and weaponized information was used in the campaign on both sides. And this was something that I've never heard anyone, especially a non-techie, explain so well. But it happens that the Republicans had this system called Orca that they used for Mitt Romney, and they thought it was pretty cool, but it wasn't because it didn't work. So they've been working on it since then to get it right. They got it right. Then they found another group that was really good at, you know, spinning these stories and doing stuff like that and targeting, and they brought them in. And then we don't know how, but at some point, the Russians got involved. She pointed out that this was, and she gave several examples. She said this could not have happened unless there was not just collusion, but actual cooperation. She feels strongly, and she's got the data points, believe me, down to the hours, that yes, the Russian people who were the 1,000 agents who were working to swing the election and the other groups within Russia, like RT and them, she said, yeah, those people had to have worked with somebody on this soil who knew deeply how things in electoral United States worked. And she made the case, and it worked for me. I thought to myself, good God, she's right. That they're talking about collusion and trying to prove it. It's kind of staring us in the face, in a way. So that's the part. That's part of that interview that I'd recommend people. If you're interested in politics and interested in getting some kind of closure and understanding of Hillary Clinton, what she did, what she didn't do, and what's happening to our country with regard to our electoral process, she also said one other thing. I'm going to bring up, John. That is, she used a word I've never heard before with respect to what the Russians are trying to do with their information, their cyber attacks, their information weaponization, and other things. She said, you know, she said, I don't think we've used the right word for this. They're not trying to disrupt. They're not trying to discredit. They're not necessarily working for Donald Trump. She said what they're doing is they're changing our reality. I've never heard anyone say that before. And I think that's true. What's happening is they're getting us to change the way we look at the world and at our reality. And it does work. And Hillary brought out several examples. She goes back to data. She says, I went back and started looking at Google searches. There's a history of all the Google searches and stuff. And she said it's kind of remarkable what people started searching for and how it changed when these fake news stories really hit. And she brought another thing. Yeah, and she said, here's a good one. She said, okay, there's a point in time where this tape of Donald Trump speaking unbelievably crudely about groping women comes out. She said, within an hour, that's 60 minutes, within an hour, WikiLeaks drops the John Podesta emails. An hour, mm-hmm. John. Within an hour. Yeah. So that is, like she said, this is a machine. This is not an accident. This isn't WikiLeaks acting alone. This is a concerted effort, and boy, did it work. They had no countermeasures to this at all. The Democrats always had a good tech operation in there, but they actually were using it to get their message out. They weren't using it to destroy people. But that's not the case of what happened in the other side. And the other side wasn't just Republicans. There's more people involved. So anyways.
Well, as we kind of wind down on this, I wanted to kind of, I'm going to put out a question here that's going to demonstrate my ignorance. And that is, how come all these other countries have been able to get women leaders, presidents, such as England, Germany's, the one that's been on the news right now. We know that we could cite India, we could cite Israel, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How come they're able to get women presidents and we're not?
Well, this is a good question. And, the thing is that what we tend to do when we look at this question is, especially with this new reality and new self-doubt that has been planted in our minds, we start to think, well, maybe we are a bunch of brutes. Maybe we are ugly Americans. Maybe we are so misogynistic and paternalistic that we can't do this. Maybe the rest of the world's way ahead of us. And you know what? I don't think it's true. And here's why. I think we're the same as everybody else. I don't believe in American exceptionalism, but I also don't believe in American inferiority. Here's what I think it is. Those countries, all of them that you cited, are parliamentary. That's how it happened. Because what happens is, in our system, as you know, it's not parliamentary. We can't get beyond two parties. And what happens is we more or less directly elect, except the Electoral College, our candidates. Yeah. And that doesn't happen on the parliamentary system. And so people accept it. Disraeli, he's a great example in England. They elected a Jew, prime minister, a long time ago, which was unheard of. How could that happen? It's parliamentary politics work completely differently than our politics. And there are some advantages, there's some disadvantages, but it's built on coalitions, and the parliamentarians elect who's going to be the prime minister.
In other words, if we were going to have a comparable system, it's sort of like saying that the Senate and the House would be the ones who do the voting in order to get our president. Is that
correct?
Is that
and we would be multi-party. We would have at least three parties, maybe four or five.
Yeah. The other thing that is that that's very good. And a lot of people just kind of slips their mind. It did mine too. I wasn't aware. I kind of knew it, but I wasn't thinking it at the time. Mm. The other piece I want to point out here, and it sort of, this goes in terms of the misogynist viewpoint, or it's corporate business as usual.
Yeah.
Is the fact that it's cited in here. It says, oh, well, Hillary lost. That sounds like just another Tuesday in the corporate world.
No, Tuesday in America.
Tuesday, yeah. In America, in America, basically citing the fact that the glass ceiling is what it's implying.
Yeah.
That Hillary was a classic example. She rose to the ranks, but got to that point where she was going to be the ultimate decision maker, and all of a sudden, people are, there's an element of our population that got cold feet and said, hey, do we want her making these decisions? And I don't know if it was intuitive or whatever, what made people do it, but this is a piece of the exercise.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like the corporate world in America.
No, it is. No doubt. That is there. But, that can be overcome. If you have a group a couple hundred people who are well-educated can deal with having a woman be the boss. 60, 70, 80, 260 million? No, I don't think so.
In fact, I've worked probably at least 75 to 80% of my career as an accountant in nonprofit organizations. I've reported to women.
Right.
And they're usually the number one person.
Yeah.
And to me, when I took a look at this election, I looked at the candidates, Trump versus Hillary. What rationalized Hillary, as much as I've kind of, talked about the fact that I couldn't think she'd pull the trigger. To me, I was able to rationalize voting for her because I said, this is would be a fresh, new approach. Let's give a woman a chance and get her in there and see what, you know, can happen.
Yeah.
That's the what really kind of was my rationalization for voting for her.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I think, yeah, it's interesting. You can have that reaction to it or the very opposite, which a lot of people did have.
Yeah.
The number of women who voted for Trump is kind of astounding.
Oh, that's another thing that's in this article.
Yeah, yeah, it sure is, isn't it? It sure is. Well, we can go on for another hour about this.
Yeah,
we better tie it up.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay, so, John. Good times. Thank you very much for all the work you did on this.
I thoroughly enjoyed this.
All right, buddy. I will talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds like a winner. I'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.